Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of Dr. Robert Lustig on why our diet is killing us. It's not the fat, it's the sugar, and it's one sugar in particular, fructose. I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to a bold speech by Dr. Robert Lustig, physician and medical researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. His claim, there is one clear villain that is causing America's current epidemic of heart disease, hypertension, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, some types of liver disease, obesity, metabolic syndrome, and general fatness. That cause is the huge and still growing amount of sugar we eat. Yes, what's clogging your arteries with cholesterol is not the fat in that Big Mac you just ate. It's the sugar in the 40-ounce Coke you washed it down with. Plus the sugar in the bun, the pickle, the ketchup, the mustard, not to mention our own special sauce. Not all sugars are bad, Lustig states. Glucose is okay. The villain is fructose, as in high fructose corn syrup. But old-fashioned cane sugar, sucrose, is just as bad. The body breaks down sucrose and turns much of it into fructose. Fructose is dirt cheap to manufacture. The food industry is adding the stuff hand over fist to practically every processed food. And the food industry is removing nature's own antidote to fructose, which is fiber. A part of Lustig's original lecture is a long explanation of the biochemistry of fructose metabolism. Exactly how fructose damages your liver, blood vessels, pancreas, you name it. A lot of this is interesting stuff, but the details would fill a full program in itself. So I'm going to skip over most of the biochemistry details, and a few other things besides. As we pick up, Lustig talks about three things that happened in the 1970s that set off our skyrocketing consumption of fructose. The first is President Richard Nixon.
He admonished his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Rusty Butz, I love that name, to basically take food off the political table, to make food a non-issue in presidential elections. Well, the only way to do that was to make food cheap. So he was out to find all methods to be able to decrease the price of food. Remember Nixon's war on poverty? We're suffering from it today. Second political win, the advent of high fructose corn syrup. Okay? So this was invented in 1966 at Saga Medical School in Japan by a guy named Takasaki, who's still alive. As far as I'm concerned, this stuff is Japan's revenge for World War II. Except, of course, that they're suffering from it now themselves. Okay? Like everything, you know, it always comes back to haunt you. And it was introduced to the American market in 1975. So what do you think happened to the price of sugar when this thing hit the market? Up and down. Here's where corn sweeteners entered the market, 1975, 1980. And you can see that since then, the price of sugar has remained remarkably constant. And it did so not just in the U.S., but also on the international stage. Here's the London price doing the same thing. And when you look at the difference in price between sugar and high fructose corn syrup, you can see that high fructose corn syrup is about half the price. So in other words, it's cheap. So high fructose corn syrup is evil, but it's not evil because it's metabolically evil. It's evil because it's economically evil, because it's so cheap that it's found its way into everything. It's found its way into hamburger buns, pretzels, barbecue sauce, and ketchup. Somebody emailed me the other day and told me they went into their local grocery store and went through every single loaf of bread on the shelf. And out of 32 types of bread on the shelf, only one of them did not have high fructose corn syrup in it. So we are being poisoned by this stuff, and it's been added surreptitiously to all of our food, every processed food. Okay, and the question is, why? The corn refiners like to point out, well, you know, it's just been a substitution. As the high fructose corn syrup's gone up, the sugar's gone down. You know, we're just replacing, you know, like gram for gram. Well, not exactly, because here's 73 pounds of sugar per year. This is from the Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, disappearance data. 73 pounds up to 95 pounds by 2000. And there's something missing from this slide. Juice is missing, because juice is sucrose, right? Okay. So this is a study done by Miles Faith, a prospective study in inner city Harlem toddlers. And the number of juice servings per day predicts the change in BMI score per month in these inner city Harlem toddlers. Now, where do these inner city Harlem toddlers get their juice? From where? From whom? From WIC. You know what WIC is? Women, infants, children, right? A government entitlement program set up under who? Nixon, okay? To prevent failure to thrive? They did. This is the equal and opposite reaction. So let's add juice in. Here it is. And so most fructose items, when you put it together, now we're up to 113 pounds on this graph. And I just heard from Brian Williams of NBC News after the most recent study came out that was in the Journal of Clinical Investigation that we are actually up to 141 pounds of sugar per year, each of us. That's what we're up to, 141 pounds of sugar per year. Now, do you think that this might have some detrimental effects on you? Hasn't stopped you, has it? That's the point. It hasn't stopped you. That's why we need to talk about this. So juice consumption increases the risk for type 2 diabetes. Okay. So this is the relative risk ratio as juice intake goes up. And this is in the nurse's study, okay, showing, again, juice consumption, sucrose, obesity, diabetes. The third political storm, okay, that swirling around to create this disaster, this mega typhoon that happened in 1982. The USDA, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, all telling us we had to reduce our consumption of fat. Now, why did they tell us that? To stop heart disease, did we? No, we didn't. In fact, it's worked the exact opposite. We've only created more. So now, how did this come to be? Why did they tell us to stop eating fat? Well, in the early 1970s, we discovered something in our blood called LDL. Low-density lipoproteins. You've heard of that, right? Is it good or bad? Not so bad. We'll talk about it. In the mid-1970s, we learned that dietary fat raised your LDL. So if dietary fat is A and LDL is B, we learned that A led to B. Okay, dietary fat definitely increases your LDL. No argument. It's true. Okay, and then finally in the late 1970s, we learned that LDL correlated with cardiovascular disease. Okay, so let's call cardiovascular disease C. So we learned that B led to C. So the thought process by some very smart nutritionists, et cetera, you know, the USDA, et cetera, said, well, if A leads to B and B leads to C, then A must lead to C. Therefore, no A, no C. This was the logic. Now, any logicians in the room? Anybody see any problems with that logic? That's right. The premise is incorrect because this suggests that this is all transitive, but in fact, only the contrapositive is transitive. So it's not no A, no C, it's no C, no A. There's faulty logic here. But before I show you why it doesn't work, I'm going to show you that this was a battle royal back in the 1970s. This was not a simple thing. There were people lined up on both sides of this story. So this over here is a book, 1972 it came out, and it was called Pure, White, and Deadly. It's all about sugar. Written by a British physiologist, nutritionist, endocrinologist by the name of John Yudkin. Now, I never knew John Yudkin. He's passed away. But I read this book about a year ago, and without even knowing it, I was a Yudkin acolyte. I was a Yudkin disciple. Every single thing that this man said in 1972 is the God's honest truth. And if you want to read a true prophecy, you find this book. It's not easy to find, but you go find this book, and I'm telling you, every single thing this guy said has come to pass. It's astounding. I am in awe of this guy. But on the other side, we had this guy over here. Okay, his name was Ansel Keys. Anybody heard of him? Okay, so Ansel Keys was a Minnesota epidemiologist, very interested in the cause of cardiovascular disease, and he performed the first multivariate regression analysis without computers. Now, anybody know what that means? multivariate regression analysis. Okay, so this is where you take a whole lot of data. Okay, and normally you would just, you know, run a few computer programs. But basically the object is to try to figure out what causes what, and to try to factor out other things and determine what the contribution of various things all at once are to an outcome that you're looking for. So he was interested in cardiovascular disease. And so what he did was he did this study, along with other people around the world, called the Seven Countries Study. Very famous, front page of Time magazine in 1980. So here's the data on the seven-country study. We have the U.S., we have Canada, Australia, England, Wales, Italy, Japan. Okay, and here's percent calories from fat on the x-axis, and here we have coronary disease death rate on the y-axis. And so you'd say, well, look at that. I mean, it's very obvious, isn't it? Sure, percent calories from fat correlates very nicely with coronary disease, except for one little problem. Japan and Italy. So how much sugar do they eat? Didn't I tell you the Japanese diet eliminates fructose? They never even had it till we brought it to them after World War II. Italy, you know, aside from gelato, I mean, what else they got? Okay? They got a lot of pasta, there's a lot of glucose, but no fructose. Okay? There's no sugar in the Italian diet other than the occasional sweet, which they moderate. They're very careful about moderating, and they cost a lot. But here we got England, Wales, Canada, Australia, U.S. You know, we are sugarholics, aren't we? We're also fataholics. So, in fact, the fat migrated with the sugar. So, this is from Keyes's own work, okay, page 262, if you want to pick up the 500-page volume. And I'm just going to read you the one paragraph, okay, that talks about this. The fact that the incidence rate of coronary heart disease was significantly correlated with the average percentage of calories from sucrose in the diet is explained by the intercorrelation of sucrose with saturated fat. In other words, donuts. Wherever there was the fat, there was sucrose too. Because these guys here eat donuts. Partial correlation analysis show that with saturated fat constant, there was no significant correlation between dietary sucrose and the incidence of coronary heart disease. Okay. When you do a multivariate linear regression analysis, you have to do it both ways. You have to do holding fat constant, showing that sucrose doesn't work, and then you have to hold sucrose constant and show that fat still works. You see that anywhere? He didn't do it. He didn't do the thing that you need to do a multivariate linear regression analysis. Now, this was done before computers. We can't check the work. He's dead. He died in 2004. So we're left with a conundrum. Do we believe this? Do we believe this study? Because we based 30 years of nutrition, education, and information and policy in this country on this study. And as far as I'm concerned, it has a hole as big as the one in the USS Cole. Remember I told you LDL, maybe not so bad? Well, here's why. Because there really isn't one LDL. There are two. Here's one over here. It's called pattern A, or a large buoyant LDL. So everybody knows that LDL correlates with cardiovascular disease, and that's true. And I'm not going to argue that. That is true. But it's not this one. Pattern A LDL. These guys are so light, they are buoyant, they float. So they get carried through the bloodstream, and they don't even have a chance because they're so big and they're so buoyant, they don't even get underneath the edge of the endothelial cells in the vasculature to start the plaque formation process. But over here we have this other guy over here called pattern B, or small dense LDL. You see the difference? These guys are dense. These guys don't float. These guys are small. They get underneath the edge of the surface of the endothelial cells, and they start the plaque formation. And it's been shown by numerous investigators now that small, dense LDL is the bad guy. Okay, now, when we measure LDL in the bloodstream, when you do a lipid profile, you measure both of them together because it's too hard to distinguish the two. So when you get an LDL, you're getting both LDLs, the neutral one and the bad one. Now, how can you tell whether your LDL is the neutral one or the bad one? What you do is you look at your triglyceride level in association with it, because your triglycerides tell you which one it is. So here's pattern A over here, okay? Big, large, buoyant LDLs, okay? And you'll notice that the triglycerides are low and your HDL is high. That's what you want. You want a low triglyceride, high HDL, because that's the good cholesterol. You want good cholesterol. Over here you have pattern B, and here you have high triglyceride, low HDL. That's the bad guy. That's the guy you don't want to be, because you're going to die of a heart attack. No question about it. Triglyceride to HDL ratio actually predicts cardiovascular disease way better than LDL ever did. Point is, when you measure LDL, you measure both. So, dietary fat raises your large buoyant. What do you think raises your small dense? Carbohydrate. Okay, so here's percent carbohydrate, and here's your pattern B going up. Everybody got it? What did we do in 1982? We went on a high-carb diet, which was supposed to be a low-fat diet, right? So here's the low-fat craze. Took America and the world by storm because the content of low-fat, home-cooked food that you cook by yourself in your house, you can control the content of fat. But when you low-fat processed food, it tastes like cardboard. The food companies knew that, so what did they do? They had to make it palatable. So how do you make it something palatable that has no fat in it? You add the sugar. So everybody remember Snackwells? Okay, so 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of them being sugars so that it was palatable. Well, we've just shown you that that's the worst thing you could do. And that's what we've done. And we're still doing it today. So when you find a mistake, what do? You admit the mistake and you right the ship. We haven't admitted the mistake and we haven't righted the ship. So we've had our food supply adulterated, contaminated, poisoned, tainted, on purpose. And we've allowed it through the addition of fructose for palatability, especially because of the decreased fat, and also as a ostensibly browning agent, which actually has its own issues, because why it browns so well with the sugar in it actually is what's going on in your arteries, because that's causing what we call protein glycation and cross-linking, which is actually contributing to atherosclerosis. So it works on your steak on the grill. It works in your arteries the same way. And removal of fiber also. Now, why did we remove fiber from our diet? We as human beings walking the earth 50,000 years ago used to consume 100 to 300 grams of fiber per day. We now consume 12. What did we do? So why did we take the fiber out? Well, it takes too long to cook, takes too long to eat, and shelf life. So people ask me, what's the definition of fast food? Fiberless food. Okay? I dare you, other than a salad, I dare you to go to any fast food restaurant and find anything on their menu that they actually have to cook that has more than 1 gram of fiber in it, because there isn't any. And that's on purpose, because they take the fiber out, because that way they can freeze it, ship it around the world, and cook it up fast. And not only is it fast cooking, but it's fast eating, which also causes its own satiety issues. Bottom line, we have a typhoon on our hands. Okay? And then finally, the last issue was the substitution of trans fats, which are clearly a disaster. But those have been going down because we know that those are a problem. So we've actually gotten rid of most trans fats. Not completely, but most. So this is it. This is what we've done over the last 30 years. Now to the biochemistry. And let me show you why fructose is not glucose. Okay? Because what the liver does to fructose is really unique. And you've got to understand it to understand everything I've just told you. So number one, fructose is 7 times more likely than glucose to do that browning reaction, the advanced glycosylation end products. The thing that happens on your grill happens in your arteries for the same reason. Okay? You can actually see the color, too, color change, too. Fructose does not suppress the hunger hormone. There's a hormone that comes from your stomach called ghrelin you've heard about already. Okay? So when if you preload a kid with a can of soda and then you let them loose at the fast food restaurant, do they eat more or do they eat less? They eat more. They just took on 150 calories, yet they eat more. Reason? Because fructose doesn't suppress the hunger hormone ghrelin. So they eat more. Acute fructose ingestion does not stimulate insulin because there's no receptor for fructose, no transporter for fructose on the beta cell that makes insulin. So the insulin doesn't go up. Well, if the insulin doesn't go up, then leptin doesn't go up. And if leptin doesn't go up, your brain doesn't see that you ate something. Therefore, you eat more. And finally, I'm going to show you liver hepatic fructose metabolism is completely different between fructose and glucose. Completely different. And I'm going to show you before the day is out, the evening's out, that chronic fructose exposure alone, nothing else, causes this thing we call the metabolic syndrome. Everybody knows what the metabolic syndrome is? Okay, so this is the conglomerate of the following different phenomena. Obesity, type 2 diabetes, lipid problems, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease. Those all cluster together. called metabolic syndrome. I'm going to show you how fructose does every one of those. So here are the phenomena associated with chronic ethanol exposure. Hematologic disorders, electrolyte abnormalities, hypertension, cardiac dilatation, cardiomyopathy, dyslipidemia, pancreatitis, malnutrition, obesity, hepatic dysfunction, that's alcoholic steatohepatitis, fetal alcohol syndrome, and addiction. Here's fructose, 8 out of 12. Why? Because they do the same thing. Because they're metabolized the same way. Because they are the same. They come from the same place, right? How do you make ethanol? Naturally. Right. You ferment sugar. Hasn't changed because it has all the same properties, because it's basically taken care of by the liver in exactly the same way and for the same reason, because sugar and ethanol are the same every which way you turn. So here's our clinic intervention. This is what we do in our clinic. Okay, it's as simple as you can imagine. We write this on the back of a matchbook. Okay, I mean, it's just as simple as you can make it. We have four things we teach the kids to do and the parents. Get rid of every sugared liquid in the house. Bar none. Only water and milk. Okay? There is no such thing as a good sugar beverage. Period. Eat your carbohydrate with fiber. Why? Because fiber is good. Fiber is supposed to be an essential nutrient. And we can talk later, if you want, after the cameras turn off, as to why fiber is not an essential nutrient. Because the government doesn't want it to be. Because then they couldn't sell food abroad. Wait 20 minutes for second portions. Okay, to get that satiety signal. And finally, buy your screen time minute for minute with physical activity. That's the hardest one to do. Okay, so if you play for half an hour, you can watch TV for half an hour. You want to watch TV for an hour, play for an hour. That one's a hard one. But anyway, we follow our patients every 3 months. So here's my question. Does it work? Yeah, it works. So this is BMI Z-score, time from initial visit. It works. But we were interested in what made it work and what made it didn't work. So we did a multivariate linear regression analysis, right? The thing that made it not work, sugared beverage consumption. The more sugared beverages the patients drank at baseline, the less well the lifestyle intervention worked for all the reasons I just showed you. So why is exercise important in obesity? Because it burns calories? Come on. 20 minutes of jogging is one chocolate chip cookie. You can't do it. Are you joking me? So why is exercise important? Number one, it improves that skeletal muscle insulin sensitivity because your insulin actually works better at your muscle, okay, which then brings your insulin levels down, which is good for you. Number two, it's your endogenous stress reducer. It's the single thing that actually stress reduces. And if you stress reduce, what do you think your appetite does? Goes down. Because stress and obesity go hand in hand, right? For all sorts of reasons which are beyond the scope of this lecture today, but we can talk about in the question period if you want. And then finally, remember that de novo lipogenesis? Remember those three nasty enzymes? Okay. What if you burned the stuff off before you made the fat? That's what exercise does, because it makes that TCA cycle run faster, so you don't get the citrate leaving the mitochondria, so it doesn't get turned into fat, so it doesn't precipitate and cause all the problems you just saw. That's what they mean by a higher metabolism, yes. Okay? But it has nothing to do with burning of calories. That is the stupidest reason that I've ever heard of for exercise. You got to be joking me. Okay? You can't do it. I mean, one Big Mac, you know, and you've got to, you know, mountain bike for 10 hours. Are you joking? Okay, so why is fiber important in obesity? So this is my motto in clinic. When God made the poison, he packaged it with the antidote. Okay, because fructose is a poison. I think I've hopefully shown you that. Okay, but wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber. Do you ever see a piece of sugar cane? It's a stick. Right? You can't even chew the damn thing, right? You got to suck the stuff out like that, right? I mean, how many calories do you think you're going to get out of a piece of sugar cane? They actually did studies on the sugar plantations back in the early 1900s. Okay, all of the workers were healthy and lived longer than the sugar executives who got the processed product. How about that? Wonder why. Okay, so eat your carbohydrate with fiber. That's why we say that. That includes sugar. That's why fruit's okay. Because number one, it limits how much fructose you're going to take in. And number two, it gives you an essential nutrient, which you needed in the first place. And you get some micronutrients along with it so that you actually can, your liver works healthier. So, in summary, fructose, and I don't care what the vehicle is, it's irrelevant. Sucrose or high fructose corn syrup, I don't care. Fructose consumption has increased in the past 30 years, coinciding with the obesity epidemic. A calorie is not a calorie. Okay? And the dietitians in this country are actually perpetrating this on us. Because the more you think a calorie is a calorie, the more you think, well, then if you ate less and exercised more, it would work. It doesn't. All of the studies show it doesn't work. Here's why it doesn't work. Because a calorie is not a calorie. Fructose is not glucose. We know a calorie is not a calorie because there are good fats and bad fats. There's good protein and bad protein. Okay, there's good carbohydrate and bad carbohydrate. And glucose is good carbohydrate. Glucose is the energy of life. Fructose, okay, is poison. You are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And what you do with fructose is particularly egregious and dangerous. Hepatic fructose metabolism leads to all the manifestations of the metabolic syndrome. Hypertension through that uric acid pathway, de novo lipogenesis, dyslipidemia, hepatic steatosis through that DNL pathway, those three enzymes, the new fat-making pathway, inflammation through junk 1, hepatic insulin resistance because of the serine phosphorylation of IRS1, obesity because of the VLDL transport to the adipocyte, and leptin resistance promoting continuous consumption, basically starving your brain, making you think you need more. Fructose ingestion interferes with obesity intervention, as we showed in our clinic. The more soft drinks, the less well diet and exercise actually worked. Fructose is a chronic hepatotoxin for the same reason that alcohol is. The only difference is alcohol is metabolized by the brain, so you get alcohol effects. Fructose is not metabolized by the brain, so you don't get those effects, but everything else it does is the same. But the FDA can't and won't regulate it. It's up to us. I'm Robert Lustig, and I'm here to recruit you in the war against bad food. Okay? And this is what's bad.
Dr. Robert Lustig, concluding Sugar, the Bitter Truth. Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net nicely adapted this long lecture to radio, and I have cut it down still further. Thanks again to Robin. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find our nearly complete archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, once again suggesting Illegitimi non-carborundum. Try to live each day as though the truth were true. Please come back again next week and keep in mind that you are not alone. Ciao.